Welcome to the YPO-WPO GCC Iran Post-November 24th Nuclear Deadline Opportunities and Challenges conference call. My name is Laura, and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Mr. Dick Simon, WPO President Action Network. Mr. Simon, you may begin.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to YPOers and WPOers around the world. And thank you very much for joining our call this morning. The topic for today's call is about Iran post the November 24th, quote, deadline, and what the situation is like right now in Iran on the ground from a political standpoint, from an economic and cultural standpoint, as well as we are going to hear from some members who have been to Iran in the past from America as part of Iran experiences in 2013 and 14, and we'll hear a little bit about an opportunity for those people who may be interested in going to Iran in the Iran experience 2000. So let's begin with Cyrus Razaghi. Cyrus is in multiple businesses throughout the Middle East, focused in Iran, living in Tehran, is co-championing and has co-championed all, now it will be all three of the Iran experiences. His businesses are related to consulting and e-commerce. 11 years ago, he's a Canadian Iranian, and 11 years ago, he moved from various stints in the United States, the UK, and Canada back to Tehran to pursue business opportunities and living there. So without further introduction, I'd love to introduce you to Cyrus Razaghi, who is fantastic and who will be speaking about the political situation and current expectations and mood in Tehran. Cyrus.
Thank you. Thank you, Dick, and hello to you all. I'll be briefly covering the expectations, people's expectations from the negotiations, the mood in Tehran, a little bit of the geopolitical issues, before turning you over to Andreas, who will cover the foreign investors' perspective. So obviously, the mood in Iran was that of disappointment after the Vienna talks ended. The population and many businesses were expecting better news, and in fact, even street celebrations were expected in Tehran and other major cities. But obviously, some of us had a feeling that the grand bargain won't happen now. There was an immediate aftershock, negative impact on the currency and stock markets, and the results of the Vienna talks, coupled with the falling oil prices, made the situation sort of worse before a slight bounce back in the past couple of days. So why the last round of negotiations didn't produce sort of more positive results? And in my opinion, there were several reasons for this. Everybody knows that the technical gaps were still too wide, and the two main parties, i.e. Iran and the U.S., decided to stick to their positions. And there were talks about some last-minute proposals and suggestions, which would take longer to look into. But I think more importantly was the fact that the two major parties, Iran and the U.S., felt it was perhaps too early and too risky to rush into a comprehensive deal, and therefore, are sticking to their positions on the enrichment and sanctions, the two key issues, and didn't want to, make further concessions at this point. Obviously, with the new Congress convening in a few weeks, many in Iran believe that, there's no point in signing an accord that cannot be perhaps fully implemented, especially with regards to the sanctions, and hence the extra pressure from the conservatives in Iran to get, maximum concessions on, sanctions now at this particular point. The American side was also under tremendous pressure from the likes of the Saudi Arabia, Israel, and also was very conscious of the upcoming, change in the Congress. And that's why it looks like the parties decided it's better to stay in the, comfort zone of the status quo. And of course, we know that the problem with that is that, status quo cannot go on indefinitely, and the parties will be facing the same hard issues and decisions and obstacles later this month and in January after the new Congress in the U.S. convenes. So that was the bad news. But can one still be optimistic despite all this? And I believe absolutely yes. The biggest reason for this, in my opinion, is that the overwhelming majority of people in both Iran and the U.S. want a peaceful resolution to this nuclear standoff. They want a deal. Various polls put this at around 65% in the U.S. and well above 75 or even 80% in some cases in Iran. This is something that the politicians in Tehran and Washington will have to keep in mind for the next round. Also, the leadership on both sides seem to be committed to reaching a deal, and in fact, they need it. In Iran, is you know, the economic situation, the embargo, falling oil prices, and that's why the Supreme Leader came out very strongly to support the extension of the talks and basically prevented the conservatives in the parliament to attack Rouhani for continued negotiations with the West, especially the U.S. And the U.S. Is also a combination of you know, Obama's foreign policy legacy in a world where we may face a mini Cold War between the West and Russia, as well as more practical and pressing issues such as fighting the ISIS and the situation in Iraq, where Iran suddenly seems to be a natural ally of the U.S., at least in the short run. The other reason to be optimistic, to me, at least in my opinion, is that it seems that Israel may be slowly, very slowly and tacitly, coming on board with a diplomatic resolution to end the nuclear standoff. Many pro-Israeli influential figures in recent days and weeks, including the former ambassador Eisenstadt, are now softly endorsing a deal with Iran and may be able to convince Israel and Congress to allow the administration to continue on this path of dialogue. That's different with Saudi Arabia. While the issue for both Israel and Saudi Arabia is beyond Iran's nuclear capability and is more about the geopolitical changes that a deal may bring to the table, Saudi Arabia has definitely more to lose than Israel if Iran and the West reach a diplomatic and comprehensive deal, and therefore is fiercely resisting it at this point. One thing also that we should all keep in mind when it comes to dialogue between Iran and the U.S. is that we forget how far we've come in the past year alone. Prior to that, the two countries' representatives, even at the U.N., would go as far as changing directions and looking the other way when they would pass each other in the corridors of the U.N. Now the two countries' top diplomats talk face-to-face and privately for hours at a time and have developed a personal and friendly relationship. So the taboo seems to be definitely broken for good. And while we are all eagerly anticipating a deal, and it's frustrating not to have one now, let's not be unrealistic about our expectations from a three-and-a-half-decade-long sort of hostility and lack of communication and relations. But I believe there is a strong case that a deal is possible in the coming weeks and months. And finally, the business community obviously is having a hard time because there is an added element, unexpected added element to the equation in Iran, and that's falling prices of oil, which contributed to the local currency depreciating, devaluating. This more than the failure in reaching a deal is hurting the currency market right now. But business people in Iran have learned to adapt quickly. So the new norm is the market seems to be semi-permanent uncertainty and unfortunately a little bit of a twilight zone until we reach an accord. So in the short term, business people are committing to short-term spot contracts and deals as opposed to a permanent one and longer-term ones. With that, let me turn you over to Andreas, a dear friend and colleague who will bring in the foreign investor's perspective into this discussion. Thank you.
Great. So let me introduce thank you, Cyrus, for your incredible insights. And let me introduce Andreas Schweitzer, who, by the way, is coming through the Doing Business in Iran network. And this call is being co-sponsored by the Peace Action Network, the Doing Business in Iran Network, and the Global Diplomacy and Public Policy Networks. So Andreas is Swiss-Iranian, living in London, runs an industrial agency business, and in 2009 started started investing and getting involved in the Iranian energy sector and now makes monthly trips there with his company having a permanent presence and really is almost living in two places at once. So, Andreas, thank you for joining the call, and can you give us a sense as to foreign investment perspective and any other insights?
Thank you very much, Dick. Cyrus, thank you too, and a very good day or evening to all of us. And I apologize. So we decided in 2009 out of a spur-of-the-moment idea to invest in the wind industry in Iran. Why wind? Because it was just a proposal that brought us through other business friends to Iran, and I like startups, and for me, Iran is probably the biggest and most interesting startup I will ever come across to in my business life. And it is an endless opportunity, and while a list of everything is a dangerous item, because it quickly can end up with a list of nothing and chase many opportunities, and at the end of the year all you have done was spend money, we have decided we look into the energy sector for various reasons. First of all, it's a sector the government likes. It is politically pretty safe. Where, when I talk energy, I mean alternative energy. We stay away from everything that is not completely above board. We have a criminal lawyer very close to us because the remedy, this is the only remedy to sanctions or the risk of sanctions is, of course, a penalty. And we are not in the commercial law, but in the criminal law. The problem, if you do business there with sanctions, you have the U.S. sanctions, the EU sanctions, the UN sanctions, and it's all not a stable situation. Sanctions are added, others are taken off. So you need, like a pilot, a checklist on how to do business. And regardless if one thinks one knows how to do it, we decided to stick to our doing business in Iran checklist for every trade. We look at the buyer, the seller, the investor of the buyer, the seller, or the owner of the business, and the banks involved. What we've also realized is that you have a lot of opportunity to do business in Iran. The real issue is, as Cyrus said, it's the nuclear debate, and with that comes certain restrictions. So if you stay away from oil and gas, hardware, from centrifuges and all the things which are really obviously not the right thing to do, you find in the real estate sector, in the stock market, in energy, a lot of opportunities. The other thing what I like in Iran, and that's why I've decided to stay, it's still a pick and choose place. You can pick and you can choose the deals you want and you don't want. And there are a lot of deals available whereby one probably only wants a very few of those. One of the issues which are a bit depressing in Iran is that where really the sanctions have hurt the society for us is in middle management education. So if you decide to invest in a business or run a business there, while you find top-educated, C-level management, chief executive operating officers, chief any of those kind, once you are one notch below, that's when you realize that the lack of education hurts and you have to be there present. That came the decision that we say we stay there because if we don't, then we probably put our business at risk. In the meantime, we represent quite a few companies who want to come to Iran, and more companies also speak to us to get out. Iranians like to invest in brands. They want to find brands, and they have enough money, except that they have an issue with liquidity. So bartering, if properly done, is also a field one could look into. I'm now, I think, nearly at my 7 minutes and would like to conclude here. However, I could go on for quite a while, and if you have more questions, feel free to contact me during this call or also afterwards. Thank you.
Andreas, thank you so much. And yes, you could go on for a lot longer, as could Cyrus, as could our next two speakers, and we would all be fascinated for many, many hours. There will be an opportunity for question and answers after all four speakers had an opportunity. So shifting from living in Tehran, based in Tehran, to Dari Manavi, who's a New York businessman born in Iran, who returned to Iran for the first time with the Iran experience 2014. Darish, can you share with the group your impressions, your experiences, your thoughts, and any thoughts with regard to others who might be interested in visiting the country?
Sure, sure. Just by way of background real quick, I have a background in financial services. I ran a derivatives business at Merrill Lynch for a long time. I've lived in Manhattan for the last 30 years and now do business in trade finance and also sort of trade in Brazil, South Africa, and even some in the Middle East and China. I hadn't been back to Iran for many years, and when the trip came, I had wanted to go for a long time, but something always stopped me. When this opportunity came along, I looked at it very closely, and I'm very, very glad that I jumped in and went on the trip last year. Let me just say that for some of you who probably are on the phone who live in America, as a Iranian who moved to America when I was 13 during the revolution, I had fond memories of Iran, but after many years of listening to the press here and also hearing secondhand from relatives or others who visited about how hard life is in Tehran, I really didn't have great expectations about what I was going to see. And I can just say that the trip thankfully opened my eyes to the fact that really the culture, even though there's been a revolution and things have changed from before the revolution, not everything that's changed is necessarily bad. And that for a 5,000-plus-year-old country with a culture that's very specific to the country and the people, that was what I really enjoyed seeing, that the culture hadn't changed that much, that a lot of what we hear about what's going on in Iran in the press here is has a very political bent to it and really is much more aimed at generating fear rather than understanding. So this trip for me was cathartic. I had grown to, in a way, fear what I was going to get to see there. And the beauty of the trip is that it has a great mix, a real look into the system. We had, from a business perspective, we visited the stock exchange, the top tech companies, incubators, tech incubators, which I have a follow-up story with that I'll tell you in a moment, tech incubators, and we even had a stop at home to speak to what I gather is a very, very progressive I don't know if he was an Ayatollah or a senior clergy member. What I really enjoyed on the trip was being with my American and British, I guess, colleagues and seeing their reaction, because I really was hoping against hope that things would be better. And this is, by the way, even after I was held at the airport for 5 hours, for passport stuff. This didn't happen to any of the Americans on the trip, but to Americans of Iranian background with American passports, we were held up. But I was given tea, and it was a very, frankly, pleasant experience relative to what happens to people sometimes who show up here, like my cousin last month. So my take on it, on the trip especially, is that if you have any interest in Iran, this is the way to do it because you get to see it from so many different angles. Thanks to Cyrus, a fantastic social angle, which is that you get to mingle and meet people, artists, business people, lawyers, doctors, you name it. And frankly, lots of people in restaurants that you'll meet, lots of people in the bazaar that you'll meet, and you'll really get an excellent, excellent flavor for the culture and what potential the country has. I'm a bit of a numbers guy. What I was fascinated by was, at least what they were telling us, was that the oil content of the economy is only about 20%, versus, for example, in Saudi Arabia, where it's about 85%. So the sanctions, in a way, I think, have created a much more dynamic situation in Iran, where people are just hustling. You know, coming from New York, going to Tehran, I think you'll appreciate what you see in Iran. People are trying to make a living anyway. It's almost, for me, with a finance and economics background, a laboratory of sort of animal spirits and how people manage to create a nice or at least acceptable lifestyle under the possibly the harshest climate and still have a very positive outlook. I mean, Tehran is bustling. The real estate development there is incredible. Financing is tough. So there are all sorts of domestically created ways to creatively finance apartments. My aunt, for example, who I stayed with for 4 days at the end of the trip, is moving out of her five-story apartment building, of which she has successively sold off different floors as her kids moved out, and she's only left with the bottom floor and the basement. A developer is going to completely bring down the building, turn it into a seven-story building, pay her and her tenants money to leave and come back to a brand new building with a pool and everything, just because of the location of the property and the fact that by adding two floors, they can fund the entire project. So that kind of creative financing, because there is no really simple way to find money for these transactions, people still figure out ways to make money. And that was what I would say was the best part of the trip for me. As you look around, something I estimated that something like 60% of the cars on the road were Iranian cars made in Iran. So that, again, is just an example of how in an industrious place, people get by and can make it work. And what that means to me is that down the road, and I don't think I'm not as sanguine about the sanctions issues, because I actually am involved quite a bit in the U.S. on the political front. I have good relations with a number of senators and even this administration. And although the administration is trying very hard to create a breakthrough here, I can say that even centrist to slightly left Democrats really have not taken the time to consider the issues surrounding Iran, and they are working with very, very old information and are really hearing a lot from the aforementioned enemies of Iran that Cyrus was talking about. So I'm less sanguine about relief from sanctions in the U.S. anytime soon. However, I don't think that is going to stop the dynamism in that economy. And I think that there's a positive trend developing that's going to continue. Just a last point I'll make. I just got back from Helsinki, where I was at a very large tech meetup, where I met with a gentleman that I had met in Esfahan at a tech incubator. He has a fascinating company that I'm trying to figure out how to work with outside of the country because of the sanctions. I've engaged sanctions lawyers here to try to figure out exactly what I can and can't do. The intellectual capacity in the country is very high. the schools, the colleges, universities are still producing great product. And I think because of the tough journey that a lot of these people have been through, they're coming up with solutions that you might not see elsewhere. So that's my take on it. I think that it's well worth the trip. If you can make it, please join us.
Great. Darish, thank you so much. And I will point out, so we spent a lot of time meeting with leaders of the top businesses in the country, many of whom are YPOers living in Tehran, which give a fascinating perspective. Just one little thing is I have never seen as high a percent of CEOs who are also PhDs, which is fascinating. When we talk about, like, energy and dynamism, entrepreneurs certainly speak to that. And our next and final speaker, and then we'll go to questions, is Chris Schroeder, who is a D.C.-based internet entrepreneur and investor who's run a number of internet-related companies as well as companies in the media. Most relevant here is that Chris wrote the only book about startups in the Middle East. The book is called Startup Rising. It's got massive critical acclaim. Chris had joined the trip this past year and earlier this year, and we ended up spending a lot of time with incubators, accelerators, and young entrepreneurs driving the economy. So, Chris, please share your thoughts and observations.
Dick, I can't thank you enough. It's just as a quick collection. There have actually been some superb books, obviously, written about Israel, which is part of the Middle East. But I was the first treatment in the last year to look at the Arab world and other parts of the community because something, I think, quite remarkable is happening, which I'll touch on in a moment. I just want to say, Dick, to you and Cyrus, I mean, you made what I knew was going to be an amazing trip, a complete mind blow. I've traveled all over the world, and I was not prepared for the kind of exposure and the kind of things and insights that we were able to see, you know, on this incredible incredible trip. And I want to actually add Darius to that because I think, you know, in the spirit of YPO only and in the spirit of Forum Confidential, some of the most powerful moments on this trip was with the other CEOs and executives and spouses who were there. The conversations we had, the global insight that people brought was unbelievable, but nothing was more moving. No more insight was given into the history of Iran, the culture of the Iran, and what happened in 1978 and beyond and its ramifications at the most personal level than things that Darius shared, not only from a business context, but from a personal one. So, you know, it's amazing. And I thank you guys profoundly. Look, the fact is, particularly from an American perspective, there is a tremendous amount of narrative bias about how we think about Iran. And Darius touched on, I think, some of the very important ones that Congress is seeing. And I want to emphasize how important this is because I deal with very senior people also in government and international business here in Washington. And literally when I told them I was going to Iran last year, they paused and looked at me kind of funny and said, "Are you sure? Are you really going to do that?" And I said, "Oh, this is an unbelievable time. I think I've seen stuff happening elsewhere. It must be happening here, and I've heard about amazing young talent there. Of course I'm going to go." And literally these smart, sophisticated world traveler people said to me, "But haven't you seen Argo?" I mean, it's a mind blow to stop to think about what this bias is. But what I think is an equal mind blow is that a lot of us, including myself, bring a lot of our own bias to this circumstance as well. And this was one just constant look at the way that we view not only the world, but Iran in particular going forward. You know, I was very prepared to see a fair amount of anti-Americanism on this trip, and I just couldn't get over every place we went, how much English was spoken, how people came up to us out of nowhere to ask us questions, engage with us at all issues, politically, culturally, and otherwise. I was prepared to see heavy anti-American propaganda, and by the way, it's there. You drive around Tehran, and periodically you'll see these buildings with anti-American signs. And if we visited the embassy there, which was quite our American embassy there, which was quite moving. But what was interesting, while there was some anti-American propaganda there, I think one of the big takeaways is much of it has been whitewashed over just with statements in Farsi paying tribute to the young students, but not necessarily sticking our finger in the eye. And so there really was a lot less than I thought. But the thing I was utterly unprepared for was when we drove around on the highway, there was a very, very large building with an enormous banner on it. And as we came around the bend, I thought to myself, okay, here it comes. This will be another great anti-Western thing. And what it was this enormous, beautiful cover colored banner that said both in English and Farsi, "Think Different." It was, in fact, an enormous sign promoting Apple, who, of course, isn't even allowed to be there. And as I dug around and meeting with the young people that we got to meet on this trip and others that I had brought some connections to, I realized that people's access to the Internet, even with instruction, barriers, was deeply profound, that there are over 6 million iPhones in Iran despite the bans, because young people will go to Dubai or Istanbul and they'll buy them and bring them back even though you can't get apps easily. Because they want to have something that's very powerful and useful and interesting. We met one business executive who's done a lot of amazing businesses and is obviously quite successful in what he's done there. And I asked him, what is the most interesting new business that you've done? And he said, I am the number one warranty offerer for Apple and iPhones in the country. I said, what do you mean? How does that work? Apple can't be here. He said, No, I know. But I can get some parts and I make it work. And he paused and then got a huge smile on his face. And he said, this is a great business because people pay me cash, and as you know, Apple products never break. And he kind of laughed, and it sort of gave a sense, I think, where things were going in very powerful reasons. You know, look, I think this is unbelievably important because as I learned in the Middle East generally and in emerging markets more broadly, and it's very important for us to consider in Iran, is that as we assess these very complicated and often terrible machinations at the political level, which are very serious, what you also see is that they're run fundamentally by men my age or older who have a certain outlook of life. And I have never in my life been in a time when the difference between how people my age and older, 49 years old and older, think about the world as compared to people under 30 have never been more different. And the reason why this is, I think, it's because they can. And they can because of technology. Like all of us in our 20s wanted to fix our parents' mistake. But what I think is different and very underestimated now is because of ubiquitous access to technology, people are able to see the way the rest of the world works. They're able to collaborate. They're able to connect. They're able to cross-innovate in ways that simply were not available even 4 to 5 years ago at an incredible scale. And if you have essentially all of human knowledge at your fingertips essentially for free, you tend to be able to think about the world at the premise level very different. And as Darius touched, you just kind of move and make things happen overall. Despite the top-down challenges these young people are building anyway, the government obviously knows that something here is powerful because they're, in fact, and we visited 31 incubators around the country. They tend to be focused on solving government-related problems, which I think are fine. So we saw a startup that was building a GPS service to help with busing and transportation. We saw some online tools for education. We saw some amazing technologies for agriculture, again, because the engineering talent there is, I think, so extraordinary and apparent in the first meetings overall, and that, I think, is great. But something else is happening that is endemic along the ways of what Darius was talking about before, because it's happening across the world. So, for example, the largest e-commerce company there that we in the West don't hear about but is quite well known there is a company called Daxon, and it is now probably this year, certainly into next year, will be on a run rate to do over $200 million in revenue. Other young people are doing things like this across the cities, particularly in Tehran, but not exclusively there, and certainly in their universities. There have been dozens of startup weekends, which are these global gatherings of young people to brainstorm and share ideas. There's been collaboration with Istanbul and Dubai, obviously sensitive to the rules and regulations, which is very profound and is very concerning. But at the same time, there are great emigres who have moved from Iran to Istanbul and to Dubai and other places with the hopes and expectation that sometime they're going to be ready for a new day or they'll continue to do what they do very well. If you've not followed Deb Amos at all, she's a journalist from NPR. She just did an astounding report on her visit with the startup communities broadly speaking in Turkey, but talked a lot about the Iranian diaspora that was there. And it's really worth your read, and I think will get you very intrigued by what's going on. The tourist side of Iran is spectacular, as many of you know. It's unlike almost any place that I've been in terms of its antiquity and depth and pride of culture. But I think if you want to really understand why the next 5 years can be different than the last 5 years, even with the machinations, which at the end of the day will rule so much of the day, when you actually spend time with these young people and see these businesses and see technology, you see something differently. I was told when I went over there not to bring my iPhone itself, because I'd get hacked and I'd be watched, and I'm sure all of that happened. So I bought my own local Iranian phone, and I can tell you that my family and friends never received a single text from what I sent from that phone but I was instantly able to find VPN, Open Door, and other apps that allowed instant access. 3G is in its early days there and has been fairly protected and monopolized, but that's starting to open up in different ways. And so, you know, we cannot predict what the future is, but the one thing I can tell you with 100% certainty is there are going to be a lot more people in Iran, like the rest of the world, with a lot more access to technology. And understanding that generational narrative and its ramifications is one of the very exciting and complementary things that got me thinking on this trip. So, again, I thank you all for thinking about this. I thank all of you who have done this. And I think, Dick, we're available for questions now.
Fantastic. Well, I thank you, and I thank everyone. I was just going to share sort of a personal anecdote, which gives a sense as to expectations and reality. So this is the third year that we're doing it through the WPO President's Action Network, running this Iran experience 2015, and it's open to all members and spouses. And what is fascinating to me is the fear and tension before people go, and the fact that generally within a couple of hours of arriving, everyone has this sense of, what? Really? I mean, I have a collection of like emails of nervous travelers, and these are the people who decided to go. And then once people are there, it's a completely different situation. We were walking through the bazaar in Tehran, and I was approached by an Iranian who spoke, you know, English well, and he came up and said to me, "Where are you from?" And this was on my first trip. And so I tried to dodge the question. I was like, "Well, we're an international group. We're from a lot of different countries." And then he, like, you know, put his hand on my shoulder and, like, pointed me directly. "No, where are you from?" So sort of caught and expecting a tirade. This is the first day of the trip. I said, I'm from America. He goes, huge smile, big hug, "America, we've been waiting for you for 30 years. So that's the sense of the person on the street. That's the sense of the students that we spend time with, the business leaders, the entrepreneurs. Even we did end up meeting with two different ayatollahs in two different cities, and it's incredibly different from what we're expecting or what people expect. So in terms of questions, operator, why don't I let you explain sort of technically how people queue up, and we'll also give an email address.
Of course. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There will be a delay before the first question is announced. If you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone.
Great. And if you want to send in questions by email, probably easiest, just send them directly to me, Dick, D-I-C-K, at DickSimon, D-I-C-K-S-I-M-O-N, .com. So this morning's New York Times had a story about how the U.S. and Iran are sharing a common enemy in the Islamic State and are fighting that common enemy almost as allies and yet doing everything they can to avoid it looking like they're allies. I open that question, I guess, initially to Cyrus. Any thoughts or comments on that? Does ISIS or the Islamic State create a critical bridge which may end up improving American-Iranian relations, the enemy of my enemy being my friend? What is your perspective on what will probably end up happening?
Sure, Dick. I mean, at the beginning, I think the extreme skeptics in Iran were saying that, oh, ISIS is another creation of the U.S. to basically dominate Iraq in another different way and to bring back, you know, U.S. military, etc. And I think on the other side, there were a lot of people who thought, oh, this is a great sort of new invention, or it's Iran's fault, the creation of ISIS. But obviously today, everybody thinks different. And realistically, amazingly, this sort of turn of events put Iran and the U.S. at the same side. I don't know if you saw the cover of Newsweek, but there's an interesting cover with this very famous general from the Quds Brigade, Qasem Soleimani, who was, and the title was Nemesis. He first fought America, now he's crushing ISIS. So the reality is that I think behind the doors, Iran and the U.S. are sort of tacitly coordinating and working together, and is basically becoming more and more sort of open sort of direct. That, and it's common knowledge down now that they're working together.
Very interesting. If anyone else has a comment they would like to add to that, feel free. If not, we'll go on to the next question.
Okay, we do have a question from Larry Gross from Los Angeles. Larry, your line is open.
Hi. Thanks, everybody, for such a insightful conversation. One thing that always baffles me, and I was wondering if you could shed some light on it, I saw last month that the Supreme Leader tweeted sort of like a 9-point plan on how to eliminate Israel. And what's going on with that, and what do people think when they hear that in Iran?
All right,
Yeah, okay.
Go ahead. No, go ahead,
Doc. I'd like to take a stab at that real quick. Being in New York and having many Jewish friends, and being the subject of scorn at any inkling of saying something positive of Iran often, I think I've tried to parse sort of what's going on in the country, what's going on politically, and how, you know, we in America accept that our political system is complicated, that Obama might say something that McCain might not agree with, that Israeli politics are complicated. I mean, look, the coalition is falling apart, and they're calling each other names right now. The different people in the same cabinet. Iran is no different than other countries. In fact, I'd say, given the vast history of the country and the 5,000 years of bickering, that it's more complicated than other places. You don't make it's not this place where what the Supreme Leader necessarily says goes, or what the judiciary necessarily says goes, or what the guard necessarily says goes. It's a constant struggle. And the other point that I would make is that I immediately receive emails from my friends when Khamenei makes statements like this. What I would say to you is, if you look at the language closely in the original sources, not the secondary sources, it tends to be they're very careful not to say that they want to destroy Israel and Israeli people. They say that they're specifically talking about what they view as their enemy being the Zionist, what they refer to as the Zionist government. Now, I'm not going to take a position on this because I don't agree with this animosity between the two countries. But if you're standing in Iran, and Cyrus, maybe he can say this, speak to this, and you look at Netanyahu talking about bombing Iran constantly, it probably doesn't look that different. That's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is, when we visited temples in Esfahan, and Dick and other people of Jewish descent on the trip were very keen to go visit and ask questions about what's going on for the Jewish population in Iran. And I thought that I may be paraphrasing, and maybe people will correct me, but there was a lot of interest from one of the women we met at the temple to find out whether the government was being oppressive, how they were treating people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think her response was, everything's fine. And I speak Farsi, so I was one of the people who was helping translate. And her answer was that everything's fine, except whenever Netanyahu says he's going to bomb Iran, we get some teenagers that come over and put graffiti on the wall. So it's not a one-way street. You can go to Iran. If that's your only thing that you're interested in, you can, I'm sure, elicit responses that would be very negative. On the other hand, there's so much more going on in the country. And the typical response from people is, Israel's not our enemy. You know, Israel and Iran, down the road, things are going to work out just fine. We're more worried about Pakistan. We're more worried about India, we're more worried about Russia, and we're most worried about America and Saudi Arabia. That was the response. So I don't want to talk about this stuff too much because I always feel like people think I'm biased. So it'd be great if other people, maybe Chris or others, may want to talk to that point as well.
Great. Thank you, Larry, for the question, and thank you, Cyrus and Dar on the response. I wanted to just add a very, very important distinction. Some of the strong anti-Israel statements get included, if you will, in our media as anti-Semitism or just generally anti-Jewish. So we did go to a Jewish synagogue. We did meet with members of the Jewish community. And, you know, we pressed for, you know, isn't it really some problems? And Dar would take people aside so that we didn't have our guide or minder with us to listen. And we weren't getting anything. But most significant to me is as we were going up to the synagogue, which is in a, you know, fairly busy part of Isfahan, a major city in Iran, there were two young people in their 20s who had just arrived there on bicycle, and they were both wearing Jewish yarmulkes or kippah or skull caps that more observant Jews wear. Neither of them and no one had any issue of, oh my gosh, it's going to be known that I'm Jewish, I'm going to be subject to anti-Semitism. They're actually, in Iran, you are not allowed legally to have alcohol unless you are Jewish or Christian. So there are special provisions to support minority religions in their religious practices, so long as the alcohol doesn't end up being used by Muslims where it's, you know, been determined by the Iranian government that that's prohibited. And actually, in general, but Muslims.
Dick, I want to say one more thing relating to what you just brought up. Iran, throughout its history, is the cultural touch point is being a good host. And I think people can tell you about how they were treated and whether Iranians are good hosts. That's sort of a cultural issue. But the political issue, underlying issue, is that Iran, since its inception, has been the place where oppressed people from other countries have run to. And that is something that Iranians are proud of. The idea isn't among the Iranian population that, hey, you know, we want to oppress Jews. In fact, I would say that with Americans and Jews, and there were many Jews on the trip, they go out of their way to try to dispel that concern. They go out of their way to say, hey, it's not about you, the individual. It's about politics and it's about policy. And I think that is the position that the government takes. I think that's the position that the people take. And I'm not a spokesman for this government. I left Iran because of the revolution. But I was happy to see that cultural touch point, the idea that you are a good host, that the world should be fair, is still alive and well. And I would say that most people's issue as it relates to Iranians and it relates to Israel and Palestine, most of it is that, hey, it's none of our business. But if it does exist, it's more about fairness than it is about animosity. They just don't understand how things can be so unfair.
Thank you. I just wanted to add, so in terms of risks, the biggest danger, for me at least, of going to Iran comes from this hospitality problem. You will gain weight. You spend a week there being hosted and feted, and that's the big danger. The rest of it is all just wonderful. Chris, wanted to go to you with a question here. Can you talk a little bit? Actually, and Andreas, you may have some thoughts and comments. You were addressing some of them, and you can expand on it. The challenge, the existence of sanctions create all sorts of challenges, but they also create opportunities. And can you talk about sort of that balancing, you know, how you have a criminal lawyer that's protecting you in rules that shift like sand almost daily or frequently? And, Chris, you had multiple conversations with people who were setting up businesses that were almost protected because of sanctions, creating local content opportunities. Can both of you speak to that?
I would defer to Andreas. I think would have more insight on it. There were a couple of things that I would say that surprised me. And one was sort of a conventional view from businesses from across the spectrum in Iran that the sanctions, particularly the ones on goods, were real, but actually worked around in many different ways, and some of it quite legally. I mean, there are lots of food-related companies, for example, from the West and elsewhere that have long been exempted from the rules and regulations. But I think also there have been ways people have been navigated to it. I remember one executive saying, look, if you need a John Deere tractor, you're going to be able to get a John Deere tractor. It may cost you something, but I got to tell you, that's there. Secondly, and this I think is a very important thing for us to understand about the future of economic growth in the world overall, which is we are not the only game in town. I mean, there are many of our allies that we put great pressure on, and there was an example I saw when I was there where clearly our embassy put a lot of pressure on a startup gathering that was going to happen in Dubai that was going to be connected to Iran, which got pushed to by someone somewhere to close it down. But the fact is, my plane from Istanbul to Iran, easily a third of the passengers there were Germans who were thinking about where the future may be or navigating these kinds of rules. I saw Chinese all over and Indians all over Tehran. And so, there's this view that we have to keep in mind that there is ways that people think about stuff, some of it probably illegally, but I think a lot of it structured in very powerful ways, that I think had some ramifications overall. So, I think it's what was also telling to me was how impactful and really is a tool of diplomacy, let alone war today, that's coming to bear. Our financial sanctions, however, are. And that ramification, I think, has been absolutely enormous in just basic business getting done across the board. My general takeaway, Dick, and I defer to Andres and others here, is that really for Westerners to engage in business, if they've not been doing it for a while or have worked around the restrictions appropriately, is extremely difficult. But again, that doesn't stop, one, young people on the ground doing very interesting creative things in the world where they can, and two, means that for those who are thinking about that the next 3 to 5 years won't be like the last 3 to 5 years, understanding who these players are, getting to know them, being appropriate partners to them where it's powerful, and doing things like Darius described in Finland, I think is going to open up some very interesting opportunities in the medium to longer term.
Thank you very much. Andreas,
I don't know if I can add something. We do this now since 5 years, obviously much less than Cyrus, but we probably have a more outside perspective and are a bit more shy maybe. So the first thing we said, we will not, and I'm Swiss and we are in Europe, so I have no reason to get involved in a U.S. business, which in our case, I would say we do not get involved in the U.S. side of business at all. So we already removed a good part from that part of the sanction. So we're trying to make our sanction life as easy as possible. All the payments we would do outside the EU, outside the US. Basically, if you deal with Iran, you look east. And just Turkey maybe, and even east of Turkey. I don't give you a recommendation. I can just tell you what we do and so for what has worked for us. The crippling thing is, of course, that Iran is cut off the Swiss system, which leads to barter opportunities. Now, in barter, you also have to look that you're not coming into some money laundering situation, so you have to make very sure that the product you barter is completely non-touched by sanction, and there's plenty of it, the whole food business. I mean, Cargill is involved, and Cargill is one of the biggest suppliers of wheat to the country. There are big companies in there, and interestingly enough, the third-party clients who deal with us now is not the SME company, which I would have thought, but it's really large multi-billion companies who either have never left or have enough reason to go there and also have a budget. And the best they have for us, they have a big compliance team who keep me safe also. Now, circumventing sanctions, I think, is a very, very bad idea. I would simply check them very carefully and then stick to it. And if someone wants a gas compressor, at least we wouldn't touch it. So you have to be very clear in your thinking what you accept and what you don't accept. And yes, you can always bring in the odd tractor because no one really bothers. But the problem is after and the after service. So you cannot build a business. And sanctions prevent a large-scale effect. They don't prevent someone bringing an iPhone or bringing a tractor. So it's also an issue of size of business.
Great. Thank you very much. So as we're coming toward the end of the call, I was going to ask if each of the participants had like sort of a maximum 30 seconds of some message that they wanted to make sure people got and heard, what might that be? So I'll let whoever would like to start can go first, and then we'll just go through everybody to the extent everybody has a comment. Just a quick but important last thought.
Hey, Dick, it's Cyrus. I after the trip, last trip, what Chris and Dar have been doing is fantastic. They have become very balanced, objective, sort of goodwill ambassador between Iran and the U.S., and this is very much needed. It's not only up to politicians, but to people, to entrepreneurs, to business people to build these bridges. They're doing a fantastic job, and I hope the rest of us can do that as well.
Great. Thank you, and I'll add that there have been multiple articles in Canadian press and elsewhere coming out of this goal of broadening perspective, not becoming an apologist, but broadening perspective and really understanding the situation on the ground. So thank you very much.
I'll just say that my other than meeting everyone on the trip, and especially I've become good friends with many like Chris, who we see each other now. The most interesting perspective for me was from one of the members of the trip who had been a Marine, served in Iraq, did business very closely in the Gulf with a lot of the Arab leaders. And he had a very, very, very negative perspective on Iran, and was, I felt, there to reinforce his negative perspective. After 6 or 7 days on the trip, I think he was actually among the most vocal in his support for young people that he met in Iran and his willingness to support them in their endeavors, in their entrepreneurial endeavors. So that to me was very heartening, and it proved that this kind of trip is probably best for the people who are most concerned about Iran, because safety is not going to be an issue. You're going to see a place that you have, that one of the last places in the world that is so different and sort of running its own course. And I think it's a very eye-opening experience.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank you very much.
Andreas, the reputation of Iran, sadly, is awful, to summarize it. And what you read in the press has really little to do with what you experience in the country. So I could add is reiterate, please join the YPO or any other trip to Iran. You will see a different world, and you will enjoy it thoroughly.
Me just adding on to that particular point, which I could not agree with more, but touching on what both Osiris and Darius said as well as Andreas. If you've not seen it yet, I urge you to watch, easily found online at CNN.com, is of all things Anthony Bourdain, who's the great chef and has a very fun TV show where he's gone to many different countries and many different cities to look at those countries and culture through the lens of food and cooking. But the shows have become much, much more than that. He did one on Israel, Palestine. He's Jewish. It was very controversial in many communities, but very direct and provocative. More so than almost, and more balanced than almost any news show I've seen. But his segment just a few weeks ago on Iran is probably as good as anything that I've seen that shows the power of what we've seen and also the complexity, frustration, and even scariness of what's there. I agree with Darius. I think our personal safety is not an issue at all. But you know, one of the people that he interviewed happens to be a dear friend of mine and was a good resource to us on this trip, Jason Rezalian, who is the Washington Post a correspondent who is in day 140. Of being imprisoned for no apparent reason. And so those forces are real too. But for those of you who have traveled and do so much work in emerging growth markets, you know that we live in worlds of multiple narratives and multiple of issues to wrestle. And the beauty of this trip is you get to see a narrative, and the beauty of this episode, which I urge you to watch, is you get to see another narrative in parallel with the ones that we're tended to be most exposed to, which I think changes our outlook not only about this remarkable country and people, but about how we think about the world more broadly.
Well, thank
maybe you
for
could
that.
Upload.
Thank
could you upload right. That maybe on the Iran group? This
yeah.
Interview.
Yeah,
I will.
The link. It's just a CNN.com link. I'll send that to Dick, and we'll get it up.
Great.
And at the same time, maybe I could.
60 Minutes was shooting what became a great sort of person on the street story, also explaining the complexities. But Anthony Bourdain's, that's an incredible piece, Chris. Thank you. So I thank everyone. Let me just a few logistic details. The Iran Experience 2015 that everyone's been referring to is from April 1st through April 19th. We'll be visiting several cities in Iran, Tehran, Shiraz, Isfahan, Qom, and having incredible access. This is your opportunity to see somewhere that you probably otherwise wouldn't get to with fellow YPO and WPOers and spouses, and incredibly importantly, hosted by Cyrus and other YPOers living in Iran and sharing their access, their experience, and their amazing relationship. There aren't many other opportunities that I'm aware of where, in one day you sit down with an Ayatollah, with someone else who regularly meets with a supreme leader, at another point go to a rock concert and hang out with a bunch of young entrepreneurs, and then go to the stock exchange. So it's amazing. I totally encourage people. I will make sure that everyone has information about it to the extent you want to learn more. Again, thank you so much to our resources and speakers. Thank you to all of you for joining, and have a great day.
Thank you
all. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Bye. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.